I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Nobel Award-winning behavioral economist and psychologist Daniel Kahneman. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Daniel Kahneman.
Israeli-American research psychologist Danny Kahneman, one of the only non-economists to earn the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences, is a pioneer of behavioral economics, a field devoted to explaining why people make irrational economic choices. He's here this evening to illuminate what he calls the, quote, machinery of the mind, or the two systems that drive the way we think and make choices. System one is fast, intuitive, and emotional. System two is slower, more deliberative, and more logical. Please join me in welcoming Danny Kahneman to the JCCSF.
Thank you. There is an aspect of sort of my reputation that I dislike. I'm often called or labeled a sort of prophet of irrationality, that my claim to fame, along with my late colleague Amos Tversky, is that we show that people are irrational. That always, I find that really irritating, because I don't think this is what we showed at all. The word irrational conveys impulsive irrationality, frothing at the mouth. That is absolutely not what we ever did or ever studied. Amos Tversky and I, many years ago, began to study intuitive thinking. And the way that we studied intuitive thinking was by constructing puzzles for each other and for ourselves. Now, mostly the puzzle that we constructed, we could solve. So we knew how to compute the correct answer. But we were also able to see that very frequently those puzzles pulled us. There was an intuition that we had, something that came by itself, that we wished to say, that was not correct. This is not irrationality. This is the way the mind works calmly, without emotion, and certainly without frothing at the mouth. The label of rationality got attached to our work because there is a theory that assumes that people are rational. And that assumption that people are fully rational is part of economic theory for very good reasons. It's not a sort of mistake that they make. It is really very much easier to do economics if you are able to assume that people act rationally in the service of their own interest. Then you can more easily predict the way that markets will work. So clearly, people are not rational by that definition, by the definition of economic rationality or by the definition of rationality that philosophers endorse and decision theorists endorse. That definition is completely impossible for a finite mind. It's not even relevant to what a finite mind can do, because according to that definition, all your beliefs are consistent, all your preferences are consistent, and they're consistent with each other, and you have sort of perfect vision, not necessarily that you know everything, but that you can see your taste into the future, you can project consequences into the future, probabilistically, not certainty, but you can do it. People can't do all that. And in that sense, they're not rational. But my view is that people are quite reasonable most of the time, that most of the things that they do are just fine. And we need to have a theory of the mind that explains both the marvels and the flaws of what people are able to do. And I'm going to try to present such a view today. And the basic idea in this, it's quite straightforward, really, you can all detect it in yourselves, is that there are, I think, two quite different ways in which ideas come to mind. So this is one way, and notice what happened to you when you saw that. You knew that this lady is angry just as immediately as you knew that her hair was dark. Furthermore, what you knew was not a judgment, it was an impression, a very compelling impression. Then, you know, in another stage, as it were, you could put words onto it, or you could label it, but the impression was immediate. Furthermore, it's not only that you saw the present. There is a prediction in that. You know what she's going to say next, or at least you know that it's not going to be pleasant to hear. And so this is one mode of thinking, one mode of perceiving. We perceive things that way. Intuitions come that way. Impressions come that way. Emotions come that way. We tend to feel that these are things that happen to us. You didn't decide to see this lady as angry. It just happened. And that's the way that we experience most of what we experience. We experience it passively. It just comes to mind. We recognize things. We recognize people. We have no idea why we recognize them, but we do. And that is one way that thoughts come to mind. Now, there is another way that thoughts come to mind, and, you know, this is it. You recognize it as a multiplication problem very quickly, and, you know, and you would be able to do this, I suppose, and it's hard. Now, there are several stages that you've got to go through. You've got to notice or to recognize this is a multiplication problem. You've got to retrieve a program for doing that you learned in school. You've got to apply this. There are going to be intermediate products. You've got to keep those in mind while knowing where you are and where you want to go next. And this is effortful. This is something you do. It is not something that happens to you. You know that you're doing it. There is a sense of agency. There is a sense of choice that is associated with it. And there is effort. And the effort has two manifestations. One of them is physiological. There are changes in your body when you compute, in particular, something that I studied many years ago. If you compute this product, try to do it in your head, the size of your pupil will dilate very markedly. In fact, it will increase in size about 50% for a problem like this. And then it will collapse immediately back to its normal size when you stop, either because you give up or because you find the solution. But when you stop working, the physiology responds to that immediately. Then there is something else, and that is really the essence of the psychological notion of effort. It is that when you carry out one mental operation that is effortful, you are limited or restricted in your ability to do other things at the same time. So, for example, you won't be able to carry out that computation when you're making a left turn into traffic, and you certainly shouldn't try, because if you do try, or if you focus on that computation rather than on the traffic, bad things could happen. And that is because we are a limited capacity organism. We have limited capacity for allocating attention, for allocating effort, and that is an important characteristic of this mode of thinking. I will talk today very loosely about system one thinking and system two thinking. And system one is the immediate, automatic, quick, effortless kind, you know, that we saw earlier, and we'll see many more examples of what system one does. And system two is the slow, more ponderous, effortful, deliberate, and so on. That's a very different kind of activity. And system two, the main definition is that it's effortful. And system one, the main definition, the main defining characteristic, is that it's automatic and essentially is experienced as involuntary. I will use those systems as if they were agents within the mind. And this, take my word for it, is considered a very severe sin among psychologists. You're not supposed to try to explain how the mind works by introducing little agents within the mind and explaining that the mind does what those little agents do. This is not supposed to be done. I'm going to do it anyway, and I'm going to do it not because I believe that these systems exist. They don't exist. They're fictions. They're very useful fictions. It is just easier for us to think about events in the mind as being produced by agents, because our mind is specialized for identifying, thinking about agents. We're just very, very good at that. We think of agents, we know that they do things, that they have traits. We can remember that very, very easily. And I'm just taking a ride on that characteristic of the mind, that it's so easy for us to think about agents and what they do and to remember it and to develop complex representations of their personalities. And I'm going to exploit that in order to introduce some basic experimental psychology. Whenever I say system one does, think of it, there is a does X. Think of it that X is a mental operation that is performed automatically, generally quickly, involuntarily, and so on. Much more cumbersome to do it the second way than the first, so I'll stick to the systems language. Now, there is another thing that I will describe as an operation of system two, and this is self-control. And we know that self-control is effortful because you can interfere with it. You can interfere with it by keeping people busy. So if, for example, you load people's memory by giving them seven digits to remember, and then you give them other tasks, but they know that later they'll be tested on the seven digits, that changes their performance on the other task very considerably. So, you know, to take one example, if people are given a choice between sinful chocolate cake and virtuous fruit salad while they're holding seven digits in their mind, they're more likely than usual to go for the chocolate cake. And because self-control demands effort, and it can be depleted, and it can be used by something else, and in that sense, it fits with system two. So the general image, you know, I describe it, you know, what I'm going to tell you or what's the content of the book as a psychodrama between two fictitious characters. One is the system one that constantly produces things, and then there is system two, which is sort of in control, but the main characteristic of system two is that it's really lazy. And it operates on a rule of least effort. So we're constantly monitoring what we do. We don't say everything that comes to mind. We don't do everything that comes to mind. There is control going on. But as you may see in a minute, we quite often don't control ourselves. So here is an example. It's a riddle. A bat and a ball together cost $1.10. The bat costs a dollar more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Now, the interesting thing about that riddle, don't try too hard to solve it because you won't hear what I'm saying, but the interesting thing about this riddle is that a number came to your mind immediately, which is 10 cents. I think everybody who hears that riddle, 10 cents comes to mind. 10 cents is wrong. And it's very easy to see that it's wrong, because if the ball is 10 cents, then the bat is $1.10, then the total is $1.20, and that's not what it's supposed to be. The correct answer, for further reference, just to calm you down, is 5 cents. That's the correct answer. What is interesting about this riddle is that a lot of people fail it, and a lot of very intelligent people fail it, and they fail it, you know, in questionnaires. So about 50% of students at Princeton fail this, and Harvard, and MIT, and in other universities it's much worse, believe me. So what is interesting and important about this riddle and this demonstration, is that we know for sure about the people who say 10 cents, we know one thing, they didn't check. If they had checked, they would not have said that, and it's very, very easy to check, and they didn't. So a number came to mind, it was 10 cents, and it came very quickly, it felt right, it felt true, and they just said it. And that is the mark of a lazy system too. That's, you know, they could have checked. If their life had depended on getting the correct answer, they would have checked. They're perfectly capable of checking. They just don't. And most of us, you know, don't do all that we could do to check ourselves, and it's probably a very good thing that we don't, because most of the time, the answer that is suggested by system one, the first number that comes to mind, the thought that comes to mind, most of the time they're just fine. Because the operations of system one, they include some of the things that we're born with or that we learn very early. You know, we see the world as we do, emotions are part of system one, but there is another large class of behaviors that you could attribute to system one because they have those characteristics. And those are skilled actions. So when you drive, basically driving is an operation that is almost effortless for the skilled driver. It was intensely effortful when you learned to drive, that it was a system two operation. With a lot of practice, skills migrate to system one. They become automatic. And this is high-level skill and high-level expertise. And all the stories that people love about the successes of expert intuition, for example, we all know about chess masters that can just pass by a complicated chess position and say, white mates in three. We're all familiar with the stories of firefighters who have the intuition that something very dangerous is about to happen and they escape just in time. We know about physicians who look at a patient and have an immediate sense of what the diagnosis is in some cases. All that is absolutely true. There are many cases like that. They are the marvels of intuition. And they're produced in one particular way. They're produced with a lot of experience. And they're produced with experience and with feedback about what is correct and what is not correct. So skill is a system one operation. Expertise tends to migrate to system one. And the effort required for very high level performance tends to decrease. I'll give you first an example that I find fairly dramatic of an operation, a result of how System 1 does work. This, I took that from a publication, comes from a laboratory in England. It's actually a biology lab, not a psychological one. And as in many places in England, they have a tea room. And it's a little room where people can help themselves to tea and milk and biscuits. And there is an honesty box where people pay. And somebody had the bright idea of putting a poster right on top of the honesty box. And this they did. And of changing the poster. So this is the poster they showed the first week, and that's how much they paid for milk. Then they switched to flowers for the second week, and they paid that much. Then they switched back to eyes, and then to flowers, and then to eyes. What's happening here is fairly clear. I mean, especially in the first week, you had those huge eyes staring at people, and that makes people more moral. And somebody is watching. Now, they don't know it. The important part of this is that this operation is completely unconscious. And as people were not aware, they were not aware of the posters, and they certainly were not aware that the posters were changing, and they certainly didn't know that the poster was seriously and significantly affecting their behavior. But it did. So this is a kind of operation that we attribute to System 1.
You're listening to behavioral economist and psychologist Daniel Kahneman, whose book is Thinking Fast and Slow, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Now, I'll give you another that will make you uncomfortable. Here it is. And I want to just list a few of the things that happened to you in the second or two after I presented this. And of course, first of all, you read it. And you read it without deciding to read it. You had to. This happened automatically, the reading of these words and the understanding of these words, something that happened automatically and involuntarily. Second, you made a disgust face, and you felt disgust. And you were conscious of a lot of ideas and memories and so on, you know, all quite unpleasant. And other things happen. You recoiled. I mean, that's actually been measured in psychological experiments when people are exposed to a stimulus that it's symbolically threatening. That's enough to cause people to pull back a bit. And then, and this is extremely important, those words, especially the word vomit in this case, prepares you for a lot of other things that could happen. You're not prepared for a lot of things. And in order to understand how that works, you have to think of memory, or associative memory, we call it, as a huge network of ideas which are related to each other in various ways, cause to effect, color to object, and so on. And then you present an idea, or you present something that makes contact with an idea, in this case vomit, say, and activation spreads. That activates that node, and activation spreads to associatively related ideas. This is a fundamental process that we are quite familiar with. And you can think of it as a spreading. You illuminate one node, and then more mildly, more weakly, other nodes are turned on. And you can think of them as little lights. Now, they are turned on and activated, not sufficiently for anyone to become aware of them. But if, for example, you were to hear whispered words, some words would now be much easier to recognize and identify than usually, and than other words. So the words smell and stink and nausea and sickness and so on, all of these words, there's a whole family of words which are related, and you are prepared to see them. You are ready to see them. This is the way that a lot of the operation that we call operations of system one work. They work through activation of memory. This is how we recognize things. And recognition comes with a whole package of reactions which tend to reinforce each other. Because when you make a disgust face, it enhances the feeling of disgust. And of course, when you feel disgust, you make a disgust face. When you recoil, it enhances your emotional reaction. The negative emotional reaction makes you recoil. When you have those mutually reinforcing responses, you tend to generate a pattern of activity that is coherent. It's associatively coherent. And it's an interpretation of the current situation. Now, there is another word here, and the word is banana. And what happened here is, again, something that you didn't choose to do, but we know that in memory, a causal connection was created, that somehow the banana caused the illness, the banana caused the vomit, and so, you know, temporarily you're off bananas. That all of this we know happens, and that is really the primary way that System 1 works. It works through recognition of that kind. And sometimes the recognition has in it an action component, that as soon as you recognize something, a name of it could come to mind, you know, so that's how a little child says doggy. The little child has no idea of why she says it, but it comes to mind. And a firefighter can have the sense that now is the time to leave the house because it's going to explode without knowing why. So recognition is a very rich concept. And it's a concept of creating an interpretation. It's the creation of an interpretation of the current situation. And that happens automatically. And those interpretations are really very rich. And we know that they tend to be internally consistent or coherent, and I speak of associative coherence. And I'll give you an example of how associative coherence works, and it won't be as bad as the previous one. You read that as ABC. You read that as 12, 13, 14. Everybody does. But the B and the 13 are identical. Here they are. Now, this really illustrates an important characteristic of System 1. It uses all the information. So that in order to, when you're reading the word, when you're reading the letter B or the number 13, this is done in the context of the other letters. And you tend to have a coherent interpretation. You see three letters. You don't see two letters flanking a number or the other way around. And the most important aspect of this story is that you get a coherent interpretation and you suppress the ambiguity. That is, we're not aware when we see the B that it could be a 13. That's gone. So that is the way that the system works. It tends to create coherent interpretations. And in general, it creates interpretations that are much simpler than reality. It creates interpretations that are more coherent than reality is, because that is the way that it seems to be designed to operate within the way that activation spreads between nodes tends to cause this. Now, associative memory, or system one, if you will, holds our world knowledge. It's built into the connections between the nodes in that gigantic network. And the way that it functions is a true marvel. And just to give you what I think is one of the best examples I know, it's a study in which people listen to sentences and the activity in their brain is recorded. And they hear a sentence spoken, I won't try to mimic that accent, in an upper-class British male voice. And it says, I have large tattoos all down my back. And within less than 3/10 of a second, the brain responds, and the brain responds with a surprise. An incongruity has been detected. And if you stop to think about it, this is amazing. Because you have to recognize the voice, to label the voice as internally. It has to activate this as an upper-class British voice. And then you have to make the connection that upper-class British men are not expected to have large tattoos down their back. So if we hear that connection, something is odd. And what happens, you detect the surprise. System 2 is mobilized. That is, attention is brought, because that is the way that we respond to surprises. So the marvel of System 1, and, you know, intuition comes, is just an example of this. Of this process of recognition and of this process of interpretation of what is going on. And the system actually is a representation of the world is updated in some wondrous ways. And that happens very, very quickly. My best example is a personal experience that I had. We're on vacation in Australia in a small resort. It has 40 units altogether. And that evening we went to dinner and we met, you know, a colleague from Stanford. And, oh, you know, what a coincidence, two psychologists on a small island, etc. So we are very excited about that. And then 2 weeks later, we're in London at the theater, and, you know, the lights go dark, and, you know, the show, and then we have the intermission, lights go up, and sitting next to me is John. And what is remarkable is that I was less surprised the second time than the first. And actually, if it had been anybody else that I knew, I would have been very surprised. But John is the guy I meet everywhere. I mean, it actually takes two repetitions to form a pattern. That is, the event that happens the second time brings out the memory of the first event, and now there is a pattern. And that pattern, once there is a pattern, it is less surprising. So that is the way that the system works. And, you know, anyone who would say that the system is not marvelous would clearly be wrong. Now, the system, I said, looks for causal interpretations. And that is one of the major characteristics of intuitive thinking. It is very good at causal reasoning. And it is really quite bad at statistical reasoning. That is, System 1 deals with objects, it deals with entities, and it doesn't do very well when it comes to ensembles, to collections of objects, and in particular, it does very poorly in drawing inferences from categories to individual cases. That's a more complicated story, but what I can tell you right away, I can give you an example of how we tend to think causally. Which is more probable, that a mother has blue eyes if her daughter has blue eyes, or that a daughter has blue eyes if a mother has blue eyes. And here again, there is an intuition that is widely shared, that the second feels more probable than the first. Now, what gives us the sense that it is more probable? It feels true somehow. And that is because a daughter having blue eyes if a mother has blue eyes, that flows according to the flow of causality. And that is the way that we normally think. Thinking backward relative to the causal arrow is more difficult, less natural, and what we feel as probability is the ease with which we form that representation. If we form representations easily, if it all feels coherent, if it fits, then we have a feeling of confidence. And the feeling of confidence in this case is translated into probability. And there are many examples of this tendency. Basically, you could think of System 1 as a storyteller. That is, it generates interpretations which have a time flow, which have a causal flow, and that is the way that it works. Now, I spoke earlier of expert intuitions. And expert intuitions are intuitions that are learned through experience, and there is nothing magical about them. And just to give you an example, all of you can recognize that the driver in the next lane is dangerous. You don't know why, you don't exactly identify the cues, but you get a sense of disquiet that person is likely to do something erratic, and you want to be away from that person. That's an intuition. It comes from a lot of experience. Another example that is that, you know, I can recognize my wife's mood on one word on the telephone, and everybody can. And that comes from a lot of experience and feedback that you get. But now, not all intuitions are expert intuitions. And there are intuitions that are very confident and wrong. And in order to understand how that works, we've got to have a very simple principle, which I call the idea of substitution. Okay? And it's a way that we jump to conclusions. And substitution works as follows. The first ingredient in understanding substitution is that when you try to do one thing, when the brain or the mind tries to perform one instruction, it usually does multiple things. To give you an example, I suppose your task is to detect whether pairs of words that I'm going to say rhyme or do not rhyme. And you have to do that as quickly as possible. So vote, note, rhymes. That's very easy. Vote, goat, so far as I'm pronouncing it, it rhymes too. It's harder. Now, what makes vote goat harder than vote note is that you have done something that nobody asked you to do. You saw the words, and you saw the spelling, and there was a mismatch on the spelling, and the mismatch on the spelling made it difficult for you to see that there was actually a match on the dimension that you were supposed to think about. So there is what I call a mental shotgun. That is, you have, you intend to do one thing and you perform many computations. Now, sometimes the computation that you're trying to perform is difficult and an alternative computation is much easier. So if I ask you to draw the probability of an event, that commonly is difficult, but there are other things related to probability, like the ease with which something comes to mind, or the degree to which a cause and an effect resemble each other, that you can use as a substitute. And the important aspect of substitution is you're typically not aware that you have performed it. So let me give you one example. Here the question is, what is the size of the figures, the relative size of the figures on the screen? And there is a very compelling impression that the figure on the right is larger than the figure on the left. In fact, they're equal, but on the screen. But what happens is that there is an alternative interpretation, which is much more natural, and that's what we are inclined to do, except possibly for professional painters and professional photographers who learn to resist this illusion. Most of us see that as a three-dimensional object, and as a three-dimensional object, the one on the right is indeed larger than the one on the left. This is a case of substitution. Here is another one. Buying travel insurance. That experiment was done when there were frequent terror attacks in Europe, and people were asked, how much would you pay for insurance that pays $100,000 in case of death for any reason? Now, others are asked a different question. How much would you pay for insurance that pays $100,000 in case of death in a terror incident? Now, people pay a lot more for the second than for the first. And, you know, this seems absurd, but you have to see how do people answer that question. It's an extraordinarily difficult question. How much would you pay for insurance? Well, in some way, they react to how afraid they are, and all of us are more afraid of dying in a terrorist incident than we're afraid of dying. And, you know, that's the way it is. There is a concreteness to that way of dying, and it causes more powerful emotions. And we translate those emotions into an amount of insurance, and we get to a result that, of course, is economically absurd. Now, I'll give you another example, which illustrates how the matching gets done. And this example is, here is the story. So there is a girl named Julie, and she's a graduating senior. And I'm going to tell you a fact about her, that she read fluently when she was 4. What is her GPA? And the odd thing is that I think just about all of you have an answer. A number came to mind. The best fitting number came to mind. And now we know the process by which that number comes to mind, because this is something else that System 1 can do. It can match intensities across dimensions. So how do you hear that? She read fluently at age 4. You immediately have an impression of how unusual that is, how precocious she is. You would have been more impressed if I had said she'd read fluently at age 3 or at age 2.5. So there is room to be more impressed. But age 4, she's quite precocious. You have intuitively some impression of the percentile of, you know, how far is she in that distribution. What you do, the number, the GPA that comes to mind, is just equally extreme. And that's how you get an answer, an estimate of the GPA that is intuitive, and you've just matched an evaluation or an impression of the evidence. You've picked the value of the dimension, of the target dimension, that is equally extreme or equally intense. The process is one in which very frequently, when people are asked difficult questions, they answer an easier one. So you don't go through the whole thing about what determines GPA and how much do I really know about Julie, which is precious little. And, you know, that mere fact, there's very little that you can do, and if you were doing a reasonable prediction, you wouldn't, on the basis of that, you would say she's above average, probably, as a college, as a graduating senior, not by much. Because there are so many other factors that could influence her GPA that you really don't know much if you know only that she was precocious. What is interesting and important here is that an answer comes to mind. It's the answer to the wrong question. It's the answer to a simpler question than the one that you were trying to answer. And you have it with reasonably high confidence. And that is how intuitive errors tend to be produced. This is one of the major mechanisms that produce intuitive errors. It's answering the wrong question without knowing that you're doing it. And there is another feature of the Julie story, and that other feature is that we use what we judge. We're very insensitive to the quality and quantity of the information that we have. We make judgments with high confidence if the information is coherent, if the story that gets generated is a consistent story, and we do that even if the quality of the information is very poor, and even if the amount of information on which we base that is actually very low.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features behavioral economist and psychologist Daniel Kahneman, whose book is Thinking Fast and Slow. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So that's where the mistakes of intuition come from. And there is an important lesson that comes out of this, and it is this, that when you're trying to evaluate somebody else's intuitions, and you know, there are many people who claim that their gut speaks to them and they claim to have strong intuitions, and they're professionals, the question you must ask is, are they really experts? Could they have developed expertise? And that requires living in a regular environment and an opportunity to learn the regularities in that environment. So a firefighter will do it. A chess player will do it. A poker player will do it. There is a regularity in their environment. It's statistically noisy, but there is regularity. Somebody who picks stocks on the stock market is not going to develop valid intuitions, simply because the world in which they operate is not sufficiently regular to learn intuitions. Anesthesiologists are going to do better than radiologists, because anesthesiologists get very rapid feedback on anything that they do. So they have the conditions to acquire intuitive expertise. Radiologists get very poor feedback or no feedback at all. And so they learn things, but they're not going to form intuitions. Experts and non-experts all have confidence. One of the marks of intuitive processing is that we're not stumped. We come up with things, and we come up with things with very high confidence, even when we answer the wrong question, and even when our evidence is very poor. So don't rely on people's confidence in evaluating whether you can trust them. When you want to know whether to trust someone, you have to ask whether they had the opportunity to learn whatever it is that they have an intuition about. And if they didn't have the opportunity to learn and they are confident, you can be pretty sure that they're answering the wrong question. So that's what I wanted to tell you about System 1. There is more. I mean, you know, I've written a long book. But the general picture that I wanted to leave you with is that it's marvelous and it's flawed. And it's the same system. It's a system that operates very quickly. It's the way that memory is structured. And it comes up with answers. It is not stumped. That is, when it doesn't know something, it makes a guess. And the guess is sort of consistent with the information given. It's not a random guess. And by the way, those substitutions quite frequently lead you in the ballpark of the correct answer. Not always. And systematically, they violate principles of statistics, and they violate principles of logic. But by and large, there is some consistency to it. And the main thing is, the system comes up with an answer. Most of the time, it is System 1 that governs our actions, our beliefs, and our impressions. System 2 mostly endorses what System 1 suggests. Occasionally, System 2 will sort of stop something, some disaster from happening. But by and large, this is the picture. And most of the time, what we do, we are expert at. So most of our life is spent with relatively little effort. We don't work very hard with our minds, because most of the time we know what we're doing. And when we know what we're doing, we don't have to work at computing it. So that's an image of how intuition works and why it is sometimes marvelous and sometimes flawed. And of course, there is more to it, but I'll stop here. Thank you.
There has been a lot of controversy among the different generations regarding how effectively one can multitask, with the millennials claiming that they do it very easily and naturally, and maybe Gen Xers and boomers saying it's impossible to do it that way. So in your opinion, can one effectively multitask, especially if two of the tasks involved come from a different system, like System 1 and System 2?
Well, multitasking, when the tasks are reasonably demanding, is really alternation. It's not true that people do multiple things at a time. They attend to one thing, and then they attend to another, and then they may come back to the first thing. And that is, most of multitasking has that character, that it involves rapid alternation and controlled alternation of attention. That is a System 2 function. It is hard work. But people can acquire a skill of deploying their attention. And I think they can. There is evidence that people can become better at certain types of multitasking. Whether, by and large, a generation that seems to multitask as a way of life, what that does to their brain, I think the evidence isn't in, or if the evidence is in, I don't know it. Multitasking, by the way, is a cultural thing. Americans multitask in general much, much more than other people. For example, the French, when you ask, you know, what were you doing at this time, they're much more likely to say that they were doing one thing, especially if it was eating, for example. But that's because the Americans, when they multitask, while they eat, they're doing all sorts of things. They drive, they're on the phone. And so a culture determines how much we multitask, and we get a lot of practice at it. Whether we gain or lose by it, I think the evidence isn't it. It's not, it really isn't a clear-cut case.
Hi. Is there any physical or physiological evidence for the existence of System 1 and System 2?
I described System 1 and System 2, and I knew you would forget it because they're very compelling creatures, but I described them as fictitious. I don't think that there are, we already know that there are no, you know, two systems in the brain that correspond to System 1 and System 2. One of the reasons that we can know that is that what I've called System 1 operations, which are automatic and require little attention, that includes some responses which are innate, and emotional responses, perceptual identification, and things that are overlearned, like I mentioned the capital of Russia, you think of a word comes to mind. High-level skills and very complex operations are also System 1. So the more primitive is System 1, and the most highly intelligent and complex is also System 1. System 1 can keep in mind the kind of constructions and representation that System 1 can generate. The representation of the world are extraordinarily subtle and rich. And that is a high-level operation. And so I don't believe that there is, you know, one system, one part of the brain that is responsible for all of this. There are probably patterns. We know, for example, we know that the prefrontal areas are very much involved in what we call System 2 operations. That we do know. We know associations, physiological associations of effort. We can detect that. But whether you can identify the two systems with specific parts of the brain, probably not.
Observers of the American political scene have noted that there are people, quote unquote, who vote against their interests. Is this something you've thought about?
You know, voting is a very emotional thing. I mean, it's not... My favorite study of voting recently is by my colleague at Princeton, who did an experiment basically showing people 538 pictures of two people who were the candidates for Congress. And you can show that to Princeton students for 1/10 of a second and ask them for a judgment of who looks more competent. That predicts 70% of election results. And probably is not based on anything valid, but we have powerful impressions that control a lot of our behavior, and voting clearly is, to a large extent, under emotional control. And people do not calculate their interests and vote their interests if they have moral feelings or other feelings that would direct them otherwise.
Do you believe there is a connection between intuition and imagination, or even inspiration?
Well, yes. Psychologists have that tendency to take, things that are sublime and sort of reduce them to simpler elements. The way that psychologists think of creativity, for example, is they think of it in terms of the ability to find connections between things that are very remote in that huge network. And some people are much better able to find connections than other people. And it turns out that that is an important feature of creativity. It's clearly a System 1 operation. I mean, this is something that happens. You can direct yourself in a general way to search, but either it will happen to you or it won't happen to you. We've been learning a lot of marvelous things about that process in recent years, especially how intuitive performance and creative performance are related to mood. It turns out that when you're in a bad mood, you tend to lose your intuitions because System 2 is activated when you're in a bad mood. You turn more vigilant, System 2 is activated, System 1 becomes less effective, as it were. So yes, one could, in principle, understand creativity and understand intuitions within the general context that I've been describing as operations that are largely unconscious, are automatic to a very large extent, and there will be a lot of variability between people in their ability to find those connections.
Hi, I'm hoping you can help me reconcile two opposing issues. One is that we love to jump to conclusions, and the other is that we live in a world that's far too complex, requires System 2 thinking, multivariable. Are there any ways that we can sort of use System 1 to sort of trick us into spending more time and do System 2 thinking?
That is not a mechanism that I can think of. What may happen, and this issue of whether we can train ourselves to do better comes up, so I'll anticipate the question. We can recognize situations in which our intuitions or our impressions are likely to mislead us. So, for example, I showed you a visual illusion, and when you see the next time you see that pattern of, several objects in a corridor, you will know that you cannot trust your impressions about two-dimensional size. So you learn to recognize situations in which you're likely to be led astray. Recognition, in that sense, is a System 1 thing, but it is governed by deliberate choice to learn it. And what will happen when you are in that situation, you will apply System 2. That is, this is exactly the process. You can program System 1, actually. So, for example, when you drive and you are looking for an exit on the freeway and you decide that you will exit at a certain point, when you get the sign that corresponds to your intention, your attention will be mobilized to it. You won't see the other things, but you will see the sign. So, yes, System 2 can program System 1 to activate System 2, if you want to use that language. It gets to be fairly cumbersome, but that can happen.
Could you address how conspiracy theories may arrive in the context of System 1 and System 2?
Oh, yes. We are a storytelling organism. Our brains tell us stories that we have very little control over. I mentioned the search for causes. We look for causal connections all the time. And the bigger the event, the more we look for causal connections. Now, it turns out that the world is much less orderly than most people think. And that, in part, is because of the way System 1 works. We generate coherent interpretations of the world around us. And a terrible thing happens, that whenever anything happens, we understand it. We understand things, we tell stories about things as they happen. And that gives us the impression that the world is knowable and that we can predict the future and all sorts of illusions of that kind. So you have a system that is looking for causal stories and looking for causal interpretations and generating them. And it will generate them in the absence of information. And it will generate them according to the general bent of the individual. So there will be conspiracy theories are, I would say, almost inevitable in that context. When there are large events that are chance events, the inner search for causes is going to continue and it will generate all sorts of conspiracy theories. When it's a major event like the assassination of President Kennedy, it can last for years. That people are just cannot accept the randomness of it.
Given that System 1 can so readily be draw the wrong conclusions in an almost predictable way, can it be used to direct people, misdirect people? And then secondly, could you get good enough at it so that it could be a System 1 activity?
I think it is a System 1 activity. In the first place, of course it is used. You know, all of advertisement, you know, to take one example, is of course directed at System 1. It is not directed at teaching System 2 new facts. It moves your emotions, it creates tendencies, it creates associations. So a great deal of that, a great deal of political speech is addressed to System 1 and not to System 2. And then with respect to our ability to manipulate each other, we have that ability. And we clearly, human communication is not only System 2 speaking, the System 2 of one person speaking to the System 2 of the other. There's an enormous amount of communication. We communicate things unconsciously. We communicate unintentionally. We certainly communicate emotions. And so there is a great deal of unconscious manipulation of other people, if you want to call it manipulation. We interact. And that is very largely System 1. People who think very much while they are interacting with other people look insincere, look inauthentic, they look calculating, we don't like them. So it's, yes, certainly, it's a skill interacting with other people, and skills belong with System 1. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was behavioral economist and psychologist Daniel Kahneman, whose book is Thinking, Fast and Slow. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.